been imitated, never duplicated. This is the one and only Fash the Nation, your guiding light in a sea of degeneracy.
Welcome to episode 193 of Fash the Nation. I'm Jazz Hands McFeels, joined as always by my trusty co-host, Marcus Halberstram. Another busy week so far, sir. How are you?
Yeah, I'm doing all right. Yeah, I was just thinking it's fairly light by the new standard. You know, with we got Cohen up on the hill, Democrats shilling for reparations, all this other stuff going on. And still, it's far and away not the heaviest week we've had. It's just the new tempo.
Yeah, it's the new tempo. You got Cohen hearings, I guess, in progress as we speak. But before we get to the Cohen stuff, and there's not really much there with regard to Cohen as predicted, but we just want to give a little shout out, little congratulations to our good friend Alex McNabb on his victory. He is all clear, all green, all systems go by the Commonwealth of Virginia because he literally didn't do nothing. He didn't do nothing, and the state agrees. He's now a state-sponsored shit poster. So congrats to Alex.
Yeah, definitely. Couldn't be happier for him. This is not obviously just a big win for him or TRS, but for our movement and our people and our freedom. We need more of this, much, much more of this.
Yes, we do. And it shows when you do things the right way and you play by the correct strategy and you do exactly what Alex did, you come up fucking roses.
Yeah, definitely. That's the other big point that could be made here is regarding the way to do things and the way not to do things.
Yes, sir. Well, speaking of the way not to do things, we have Michael Cohen in front of Congress today. And whatever the opposite of Jewish taquilla is, that is what he is doing. He's got that accent cranked up to about 11. He is trying to get redemption from everybody who hates Trump. But there's really if you say that it's a giant nothing burger, it's an understatement. I mean, the most like all of the things that he has said in this hearing from Donald Trump told the biggest one is like Donald Trump. I was there when Donald Trump got the phone call from Roger Stone, when Roger Stone said that there was going to be this huge email dump and he had just talked to Julian Assange. There was going to be a huge email dump in a couple days. And Trump was like, that would be really great, sort of in passing. And it's like, this is supposed to infer that there was prior knowledge with this whole thing. It's like, you know who else knew a couple days in advance each time there was going to be a big email drop from WikiLeaks? All of fucking Twitter, all of fucking 8chan and 4chan and poll. Everybody knew that it was coming. So it's like Roger Stone was probably just looking at his Twitter feed and saying, Mr. President, Mr. Trump, there is going to be a big WikiLeaks dump coming soon. I have it on good authority, like literally all of Twitter. And this is supposed to be collusion. So, wow, really hitting it out of the park, Michael. That's really impressive, hard hitting new information.
Yeah, I saw Anne was on Twitter and she made the, you would think, somewhat obvious point. It's like, well, you know, someone trying to get the scoop on the next email dump from WikiLeaks is obviously not colluding with the Russians.
Yeah, it's not at all. And I highly doubt that someone like Julian Assange was working directly with or closely with the Trump administration. They try to make Julian Assange like this, you know, right wing ideologue or this Trump sycophant. And he's not. A casual view of the history of Julian Assange sort of indicates that. So it's like Cohen also said the SDNY investigation, which is the Southern District of New York. For those of you out in Rio Rhinelander, this is the what we talked about on the Sunday show where Mueller has been transferring cases up there. to do continuing investigation work, essentially, so he can close down his probe and this shit goes on forever and ever. And Cohen has this hard hitting breaking news that SCNY is looking into the Trump administration. It's like, whoa, very big stuff. Everybody knows this. This is not new information.
No, the whole thing was set up to be a nothing burger. Byron York points this out in an article in the Washington Examiner, but I didn't even need to get it from Byron York. I was reading this piece in Vanity Fair about Cohen's upcoming testimony, and it says, you know, right there in black and white, there won't be revelations about election meddling, at least in public. The House set the scope of the hearings after consulting with both the DOJ and Senate Intelligence Committee, which are both still investigating any ties between Russian and election interference in the Trump campaign. Cohen will, however, be asked about the president's debts and payments relating to efforts to influence the election, blah, blah, blah. So just all salacious nonsense, none of which is backed up by evidence. You just have to trust the sterling reputation of Michael Cohen at this point.
And the media, I mean, look no further than CNN's reaction to this. Even Jake Tapper was saying, he was talking to Savannah Guthrie. He's like, how many minds are going to be changed by this today? And she just interrupted him and she was like, zero. Like, even they are admitting that there's nothing new. There's nothing salacious here. Even the claims about Donald Trump, in his opinion on black people, it was twofold from what I understood. The first one was when Barack Obama was still president, Trump made some comment apparently that any countries that are run by black people are shithole countries. It's like, well, he's already said that before elsewhere. And the shithole comments was fantastic. I think that was one of my favorite episodes we've ever done. Howard Stram was, I think it was FTN 110, shithole countries. And we did the whole deep dive on the 65 Immigration Act there. But yeah, that's when those comments had been made. And it's like, where's the lie, though? Right. I mean.
Yeah, definitely. It was just cognitive dissonance abounding, which you see, you know, on so many issues these days. But it was sort of a new thing when that was ricocheting around the globe.
Yeah, well, and then the other one was black people are too stupid to vote for me. And it's like, where's the lie with that, too? So.
Yeah, of course, he comes out, you know, with all these poll numbers, you know, regarding support from my African Americans and Hispanics and so on and so forth. But yeah, really, where's the lie? I have the audio of that. Do you want to go
or just do it up?
Yeah, you can hear how Jewy he sounds, like even more so than usual.
Mr. Trump is a racist. The country has seen Mr. Trump court white supremacists and bigots. You have heard him call poorer countries shitholes. His private, in private, he is even worse. He once asked me if I can name a country run by a black person that wasn't a shithole. This was when Barack Obama was president of the United States. And while we were once driving through a struggling neighborhood in Chicago, he commented that only black people could live that way.
Yeah.
And he told me that black people would never vote for him because they were too stupid. And yet I continue to work for him.
Yeah, I mean, the assertion that nobody else in America lives in the manner in which ghetto blacks live. Once again, where's the lie?
Yeah, I mean, these are pretty crystal clear observations. Nobody can really dispute these things. And that's what makes people really angry. Right. And but it's like nobody buys that any of this, you know, this kind of everybody sort of understood all this already. Like this would be like if another tape came out and Trump said, yeah, we grab women by the cunt. It's like, okay, what's the difference between grab them by the pussy, grab them by the cunt? He's already said shithole countries. He's already made these comments. And you notice like the DR3 really didn't become a heavy hitting thing until really about 12 months ago. It drips and drabs before. I mean, Trump has always had this as a businessman and as a TV guy in New York. He's always had this by necessity, this sort of friendly rapport with blacks. I mean, Jesus, before he announced he's running for president, he, you know, that there are raps that like the rappers love this guy because of the aspirational lifestyle bit. But, you know, it's obvious that like how Trump felt about them in private. And so, you know, it's not the proper response. DR3 is not the correct response. And
looking at you, Mark Meadows.
Yes, Mark Meadows. Yeah. And it's like, that's what Trump has done. And ever since, it's pretty obvious, like Cohen is the one who would have heard the most comments that Trump has made. And some of the DR3 is probably bad ideas and bad advice. But also a lot of it has to do with this particular testimony today. It's not the right course of action, but it is what he thinks is going to earn, you know, oh, the lowest unemployment for African-Americans in history. OK. Enough, guy.
Yeah, so he was obviously there looking for upcomings from all these people he's been looking to please over the last year. So I don't think he was expecting any from Stormy Daniels, though, who came out and said, Michael, I'm proud of you for finally beginning to tell the truth about what you did and trying to repair some of the harm you have caused. I can hear the pain and regret you feel for betraying your family and your country. My heart goes out to you and your family. Do you believe now that when you and the president called me a liar, when you were his attorney and you insulted me, threatened to bankrupt me and worse, that you put me and my family in danger? I remember the fear you feel. I still feel it.
Oh, man. Yeah, this is, I mean, he thinks that he's going to get some sort of leniency here, but he ultimately just gave up nothing. I mean, there's nothing substantial. And that's not even, look, if there was something substantial here, that's not even like, oh, you know, I support President Trump, and so therefore I'm going to react to some Jew who says something negative about him and with like, oh, total nothing burger, her dirt. Like, there's really nothing here. There's really nothing here. And, you know, the even this claim, like the Stormy Daniels payments were not illegal. There's nothing illegal about it. And the idea that Cohen somehow was
One legal theory was that it was illegal for him to do, but not for Trump to do.
that I wouldn't be surprised if that's the case. Yeah, well, that's why you're paid the money, right? Cohen, that's why you're paid this money. So there's really not much more to say about this. Like, as soon as these hearings terminate, this guy is going to federal prison. I mean, there's nothing that's going to stop him from going to federal prison. And he admitted in the hearings that he's going to be doing a book. So like Andrew McCabe, a lot of this, you got to read between the lines on sensational this stuff is.
Jim Jordan pointed all that out very succinctly, among other things. I thought he was doing a pretty good job as the ranking member. I don't think Elijah Cummings was very happy with him.
Mr. Chairman, here we go. Here we go. Your first big hearing, your first announced witness, Michael Cohen. I want everyone in this room to think about this. The first announced witness for the 116th Congress is a guy who is going to prison in 2 months for lying to Congress. Mr. Chairman, your chairmanship will always be identified with this hearing. And we all need to understand what this is. This is the Michael Cohen hearing presented by Lanny Davis. That's right. Lanny Davis choreographed the whole darn thing. The Clinton's best friend, loyalist, operative, Lanny Davis put this all together. We told our staff. He told the committee staff, he said the hearing was his idea. He selected this committee. He had to talk Michael Cohen into coming. And most importantly, he had to persuade the chairman to actually have it. He told us it took 2 months to get that job done, but here we are.
Yeah, and then he goes.
Hold on a second. Michael Cohen. Lying, choreographed, Lanny Davis, Jim Jordan, cool with the anti-Semitic remarks.
Oh, yeah, no, the there is a little coolant with the anti-Semitic remarks, Jim.
We're only allowed to ask certain questions, even with that amendment you just told us about. Well, Russia's now on the table. You initially told us we can't ask questions about the special counsel, can't ask questions about the Southern District of New York, can't ask questions about Russia. Nope. Nope. Only subjects we can talk about are ones you think are going to be harmful to the President of the United States. And the answers to those questions are going to come from a guy who can't be trusted. Here's what the U.S. attorney said about Mr. Cohen. While Mr. Cohen enjoyed a privileged life, his desire for ever greater wealth and influence precipitated an extensive course of criminal conduct.
Cool it with the anti-Semitic remarks.
Ever greater wealth, criminal conduct. What are you trying to say, Goy?
Yeah, I don't know. You need to back away from the line there, Mr. Jordan.
Yeah, or else we're going to have more of your wrestling students come forward and make claims about what you've done.
Yeah, exactly. Speaking of someone who needs to back away from the line, did you see Getz? He was, I guess, went out to Cohen on Twitter, I think, and was like, oh, does your wife and daughter know about all this sordid stuff and blah, blah, blah. So he was immediately the that was one of the big things that happened yesterday. Everyone, the entire complex came down on him. And here was his response.
Congressman, does your tweet amount to witness tampering?
Absolutely not. It's witness testing. When people come before the Congress with an intent to perpetuate their continuous lies, we have an opportunity and I would say an obligation to test who those people lie to. We already know that Michael Cohen lies to Congress. We already know that he lies to law enforcement. Now we're going to find out if he also lies to the people closest to him. And I think that'll tell a lot about his ability to tell the truth.
Oh man, I thought that was a. It's like no, that's this is witness testing. It's like, dude, is this a parody?
Oh man, it's good. It's good. You got any more drops on Cohen, or you want to bounce over to the joint resolution?
Nah, let's go.
All right, so joint resolution. The vote took place yesterday. This whole thing has been framed as a defeat. How embarrassing. Overwhelming opposition. Renegade GOP could sink. And of course, as we discussed on the Sunday show, the whole purpose of the Adam Schiff op-ed last week about telling Republicans to come forward and say what's in their hearts about Donald Trump, and this whole lead up to the Cohen testimony and fake impeachment crisis over Stormy Daniels payments plus Orange Man confirmed racist, that was intended to make enough Republicans defect in this vote in the House, and they're going to do more when this comes up for a vote in the Senate, so that they could get a veto proof majority vote like they did with the continuing resolution. And they didn't. They didn't at all. All the memes just sort of blew up in their face. There were 13 Republicans who voted against the measure. Justin Amash, one of them, we talked about him over the weekend. And then there were 13 others, and some of them were surprising. Thomas Massie, from Kentucky, he's usually really solid dude on a lot of things.
Yeah, but I was going to say, I thought he was one of the good ones.
He is, but he's got that libertarian streak in him. And that is why this is tantamount to big government.
Has he been hanging around with the junior senator from his state?
Must be. Yeah, that was his reasoning why he voted against it. And of course, Ted Cruz, I see you have highlighted here, was sort of signaling that may well be his reason for voting for the voting against Trump for the resolution. So kind of gay. It's like, I thought you wanted to build the wall. I thought you had all this creative stuff up your sleeve, Ted. I guess when it comes down to brass tacks, you're nothing but a fucking softy.
I don't know. I would say it remains to be seen whether or not he'll actually vote against the president. I would say Paul is more likely to, but that's just my off the cuff read.
Yeah, I think you're right, too, because that's an excellent point, Haversham. I think you're actually right on that as well, because as we pointed out on the Sunday show, there is a lot of signaling that takes place among Senate Republicans. And then they ultimately vote with the president anyway. So I think you're right that Rand Paul maybe will be the guy that dies, but he won't be. He'll never be the deciding vote. He'll only do it when he can signal. And the same will be true of Ted Cruz. Like, those guys will not be part of a veto override.
Yeah, see, that's where he differs from his father. Now, it never came down to it in any situation his father was in, particularly just because he was in the House. But he wouldn't have cared if he was the fucking deciding vote or not.
No, he wouldn't at all. So this is, they're framing this as a big defeat of Trump. And yes, Congress that is controlled by Democrats didn't vote for the wall. Surprise, surprise. So they're trying to frame it as a defeat. But this is going to be a short lived victory, as many media publications have admitted. Trump has issued his threat to veto, and that's coming. Although this bill doesn't sound like it's going to get voted on by the Senate until March. Essentially, as we discussed sort of in a mini deep dive on the weekend, it will go on the Senate calendar as a priority piece of privilege legislation. That doesn't mean that it gets voted on tomorrow. And probably, to be honest, it's probably the best that Trump is back in the country when this happens, to issue the veto immediately instead of it languishing for far too long.
Yeah, it's definitely better for him to be here for that. Yeah, McConnell has said it will be definitely on the docket before the mid-March recess. But he's made a lot of other statements lately. Yes. It's like, of all these people, these quotes that we have from senators, Pat Toomey, Rand Paul, Lamar Alexander, Mitch McConnell sounds the shakiest. It's like, hey, Mitch, how you doing over there, big guy?
Yeah, everything okay, Mitch? Yeah, so the genesis of these statements was Mike Pence had a meeting and brought two senior lawyers from the Department of Justice to the meeting with McConnell and other members of the Senate and the House to try to convince them that what Trump has done with the national emergency is perfectly constitutional. It will pass muster in front of the courts. They spent months and months writing this draft declaration, and then they hit the launch button on it. And so coming out of that meeting, Mitch McConnell said the DOJ lawyer was there to make his arguments. There were some counter arguments. I haven't reached a total conclusion. I personally couldn't handicap the outcome at this point, but we will certainly be voting on it, which is lie, lie, lie. So there were good arguments. I don't know who is making the counter arguments, and he could personally handicap the outcome at this point, as we discussed on Sunday. If he really wanted to stop the vote in the Senate, he could, but he's allowing it to come to a vote. So the argument is McConnell doesn't want this sort of uncomfortable vote to happen. He could stop it at any moment, but he's not. He's letting it go through. Now, that's probably because he wants to, if you're in McConnell's shoes and you don't want to take the fallout for this emergency declaration, it's like, all right, let the vote happen. Let people vote their conscience. It's going to get vetoed. There's not enough votes to override the end. And Trump is the one who owns the whole fucking shooting match. And that's probably his calculation. But he should be backing the president on this, and he's not.
Yeah, he sort of played this off by saying, I did go to law school. I wouldn't go to myself for a simple will. We had some real serious lawyers in there discussing the issue. But then he did. Thankfully, it's like, the good on you, Mitch. He did go on to say, we really do think there's a crisis at the border. Boy, that fucking sounds really convincing.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Mitch, for all that. We really appreciate it. Well, speaking of that, actually, and this is part of some of the lies that are being put out there on the emergency itself, is that Terry O'Shaughnessy, NORTHCOM, was in front of the Senate Armed Service Committee on February 26th. And Carl Munoz, Washington Times reporter, who has previously written for Stars and Stripes, which has over the years transformed into a treasonous and disruptive rag, focusing on pushing women, gays and trannies in the military. He also wrote for the far left Manchester Guardian as well. he basically said he penned this headline. You ready for this? Washington Times: Terrence O'Shaughnessy, 4-star Air Force general, disputes claims of border emergency. And then, of course, when you go and look at O'Shaughnessy's actual testimony, he says is that it's not a military. It's not the threats on the to our nation on the southern border are not military in nature, but they are significant and deadly. And that is by the book strict. Like, there is no Mexican military with tanks and guns on the border. But then he goes on to say that it's the flow of illegal narcotics, heavy toll on our citizens. 72,000 Americans have been killed by drug overdoses. U.S. NORTHCOM is proud of our role in counter narcotics. He also talks about intercepting human trafficking and other illicit goods and stopping illegal immigration, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So Munoz makes it seem like O'Shaughnessy is like disagreeing with the president, but he's not. He's not.
Yeah, the Washington Times, well, better than, say, the Free Beacon, can sort of be hit or miss. Well, it can be a source of good stories. Byron York, who I just mentioned, is usually fairly reliable. But yeah, this Pajit or whatever he is.
Munoz. Oh, he is a total probably Mexican, I would guess. I don't know. He's Hispanic. He's a brown guy. So, of course, he's going to be you know, advocating for his
anti-white. It's whatever. Yeah. His precise perspective, his standpoint is sort of irrelevant.
Yeah. Well, and the key to this thing with O'Shaughnessy is that that he cannot offer an opinion on if it's an emergency or not. And he says that in his testimony, in his written testimony, he says like he can't. It's not up to him to define. He said he cannot say either way, yes or no, if it's an emergency. He can only say we're providing critical support or we're not. We're doing something. There's a valid reason for us to be there or there isn't. And he basically says there's a valid reason. But because he didn't come out and say, yes, there is an emergency, that's a problem for Munoz. And then he sort of tries to drive the wedge. But important thing to note here is that anti-Trump Congressman Adam Kinzinger, who is always on the news trashing the president for various reasons, came out yesterday, actually on Sunday, on Face the Nation, that he believes that the president's national emergency is warranted. He didn't at first, but he recently returned from deployment at the border with his Air National Guard unit, and says what he saw there convinced him that the president is right to make the emergency declaration. He said, I went down there kind of undecided. Kinzinger said on Face the Nation, I think if this was just an issue of immigration, it wouldn't constitute a national emergency. I disagree with you there, Adam.
Yeah, that's cucky.
It is cucky. But he added, but what I saw was really disturbing. So, yeah.
Yeah, certainly. I remember him making a big deal of it on social media, you know, that he was, you know, putting on his uniform and deploying, blah, blah, blah. But all that aside, I would definitely be interested in a more detailed account of the things that he witnessed that inspired this change of heart.
Me too. Yeah. So the Senate vote, if you want to talk about that quickly, then we'll pivot over to some of the general immigration theories.
Just speaking of it being an emergency or not an emergency, I saw The Hill tweeted this out yesterday. The Customs and Border Patrol chief, Carla Provost, apparently was up on The Hill, and she is a white woman, a large and in charge white woman, and not a gordita. Anyway.
With no consequences to crossing the border illegally, the flow of family units across our southwest border is unprecedented. In the first 4 months of fiscal year 19, family unit apprehensions along the southwest border are 290% higher than the same period last year. For the first time in our history, family units and unaccompanied alien children make up 60% of southwest border apprehensions. We are also seeing a dangerous new trend. Families and unaccompanied children are crossing in large groups, ranging from 100 to nearly 350 people, 68 groups so far this year, compared to only 13 last year and 2 the year before.
I don't know. Sounds like an emergency to me.
Yeah, I mean, so the range of that then is between 6,800 And what was that? 300 times 68. So you're looking at 20,000. So if you talk about the range of groups that she's saying, yeah, that's a fucking crisis. And that is the crisis. Now, I'm not trying to minimize the fentanyl and the other things that are coming across the border. The sex trafficking, all that stuff is legitimate. Those are valid concerns, but it's the people. It is the people, because the brown intercontinental ballistic shit missile that is Latin American immigration into the United States, the cost of jobs, the cost of all this stuff is totally insane. And it's not just illegal immigration. Of course, we're focusing on illegal immigration for the purposes of this particular discussion. The topic of legal immigration is an even bigger one and even more damaging to the country. But this is the crisis, and it is a crisis. And to be honest, there should be an emergency declared on legal immigration as well. 1 million people a year. Get the fuck out of here. Enough. We have more immigrants in this country coming in every year. Saturation of immigrants higher than 100 years ago at this point. We are at that point. It's time to dial it back. It's time for legislative action. It's time for any and all executive action that can be done to temper that significantly, like they did in the 1920s, because we're right there again. We need to dial it back.
Yeah, definitely. And the most exotic, you know, other that we were talking about back then was Eastern Europeans and obviously Jews.
Yes. Unfortunately, too many at that time. And look what happened 30 years later, 40 years later, what happened in this country. When you do that, what's going to happen 40 years from now? Nothing good. So the wall is only part of the thing that needs to get done, but it is symbolic, and they want to deny the president that victory. And so they're setting up for a Senate vote now. It is likely going to pass this joint resolution to terminate the emergency declaration. Then it's on Trump to veto it, and may the veto be swift. Maybe the veto stamp that he uses be large and cartoonish. I hope he uses a giant one that like takes two hands and bright red ink that vetoes the bill. And then they can try to do an override. I just don't think that's happening. But again, that's why Adam Schiff is trying to meme this whole renegade GOP to start jumping ship, because if they can get veto proof majorities on the emergency declaration, then they're going to move for impeachment, because then it's within the realm of possibility. I know they're two different things, but that's going to be the momentum. But I don't think that's happening. Nobody out there is even trying to convince leftists that this is going to happen. Nobody's getting anybody's hopes up about this. It's pretty clear that it's going to get vetoed, and they don't have the votes to override it. And that's pretty much it.
Yeah, there was, there was a process outlined in the law. Congress neglected to act on an emergency situation at an appropriate time when the GOP controlled both chambers of the legislature. The administration did what they felt was necessary. Congress is going to do their part as outlined in the procedure. And that's that. The questions of whether or not it is an emergency is political. And, you know, as far as the president, you know, desecrating the Constitution or whatever, that's argument is negated by the very fact that this procedure exists.
Yep, that's right. And it would be important to point out that there has not been a single new lawsuit against the emergency declaration since the ones that we went over the last time, which was over a week and a half ago. So not a single new lawsuit. And as we pointed out on the Sunday show, because Nancy decided to pursue and Chuck decided to pursue this joint resolution route, it really undermines their ability to sue. And so they really don't have standing anyway, because they have a remedy through the joint resolution. So it makes it even tougher for them to sue at that point. And it's just, I find it interesting that there was going to be this barrage of lawsuits, and there has been a barrage of lawsuits, but they seem to have all just stopped. Now you can make the argument that, oh, they're waiting to see how this shakes out. But well, then why did the initial sort of wave of lawsuits not wait then? So, yeah, it's interesting that they all have, because what are they going to say? Herder, this is unconstitutional. Herder, orange man, racist. I mean, that's basically, none of them were substantive. So,
yeah, you have a clearly outlined method or venue for redress that does not involve the courts. Okay, no. Bye.
Yeah, there will be some more when they start breaking ground on some of these new sections of wall, which is already in progress. We're going to talk about that on the weekend. Then landowners will be in a position, like once eminent domain has actually been executed, you will see some landowner lawsuits potentially. But yeah, there's right now it's sort of all the signaling lawsuits are out of the gate, and so far no judges have ruled on any of these, and so we'll keep our eye on that. So speaking of illegal versus legal immigration, you want to talk about this George W. Bush Center slam on Trump's plan to shift jobs to U.S. graduates?
Oh, yeah. Wouldn't you know it? President George W. Bush's presidential center and other business groups are denouncing a pending regulation by the Trump administration that would open tens of thousands of U.S. jobs to young American graduates. It's like, wait, what? Am I reading this right?
You read it correctly, sir.
Trump's reform will hurt, quote, employers that have benefited for the last few years, complained Laura Collins, the director of the Economic Growth Program at the George W. Bush Presidential Center. It's all about that GDP, huh? You know, every human being on the planet is an interchangeable cog.
Just a widget.
Yeah, so the sort of background on the H-1B program. Roughly 100,000 bonus work permits have been issued via the program in question, which is dubbed the HEAD program, H-4-E-A-D. The bonus program was created by former President Obama without any approval by Congress because many H-1B workers from India are leaving the United States. The Indians are leaving because they know they have to work and wait many years to get the real payoff for their low-wage H-1B work, a green card which would allow them and their extended families to move to the U.S. His bonus program should be preserved because the extra labor helps companies and because it expands the economy, said Collins, director of, once again, the Economic Growth Program at the Bush Center. If we remove their work authorization, we will only hurt them. We will also hurt the economy and the employees that have benefited from their work and skills for the last few years. At the Bush Institute, we believe immigration is important to a growing economy. We really need to promote policies on immigration that help meet the needs of our vibrant, growing 21st century economy. These work permit recipients are investing in their communities, helping their families, and really helping grow our economy.
Yeah, our economy, our GDP, our stock market, our 401k. How about paychecks of people making between $35,000 and $75,000 a year? How about that? How about that? How about those people? Care about those people? People who were born here in this country? So, of course, they're coming out and saying these kinds of things because in 1990, President W. Down on Brown signed an immigration deal that roughly tripled the legal immigration rate, shifted wealth from wage earners to investors, and spiked stock market values. In 2006, W pushed for a massive amnesty and expansion of immigration. In 13 and 14, W also endorsed Obama's Gang of Eight legislation, which also shifted future income from employees to investors. According to a 2013 report by the CBO, which is the Congressional Budget Office, for those of you in Marie Rhinelander. And in 2016, Jeb Bush campaigned against Trump on a platform calling for more immigration to spur economic growth. So this is the absolute state of the George W. Bush Center. They cry out as they have struck you for decades with more and more immigrants and depressed wages and everything else. And now, because they're upset about this new these new sort of regulatory changes to the H-1B program, all of a sudden it's a huge problem.
Yeah, I was just looking at the next article we have here. Speaking of every person on the planet being an interchangeable cog, you know, and this is something that obviously people in our thing have talked about and addressed before. But, you know, study immigrant graduates score far below U.S. graduates. A test shows that immigrant college graduates tend to score far below levels reached by U.S. college graduates, says a report released by the Center for Immigration Studies. The test shows that foreign graduates of foreign colleges score just 34 out of 100, while Americans score 67 on the 100-point scale. Foreign graduates of American colleges scored 56, or 16% lower than the American score. Foreign educated immigrants with a college or advanced degree perform so poorly that they score at the level of natives who have only a high school diploma. It's like, oh, you mean the guy with a diploma from an online Bangladeshi university is not actually, you know, galaxy brain?
Yeah, I've seen this come up before, that like people with master's degrees and PhDs from African countries are barely at the level of like a junior in high school in the United States. I mean, it's just absolutely insane. And of course,
how many actual Americans do you know that have fucking master's degrees that are dumb shit motherfuckers?
Quite a few these days. But if it's a STEM degree or some sort of sciences degree, I mean, sort of the same thing. I was thinking more of like a STEM or a doctor from India versus a doctor from the United States. I mean, I would like to think we're still putting out halfway decent doctors if you go to a good medical school here, or you go to like MIT. But if you have a master's degree in like Brit Lit, like get the fuck out of here. Like I can smell the unkempt litter box from fucking here.
Yeah, I'm starting to see this with more STEM people. I see a lot of them get hired fresh out of college, mechanical engineers and, you know, things where you would think there's not a lot of wiggle room, but these people don't know what the fuck they're doing.
No. Yeah, it's getting really bad. I mean, this is the absolute state of our great and wonderful country. And yeah, this sort of dovetails really nicely with something I had in the bottom of the stack, but I'll bring it up now. Which is, where the fuck did it go? I guess, here we go. North Carolina lawmakers consider bill that would change school grades. House Bill 145 in front of the North Carolina General Assembly.
Well, you know, this is just on the schools, right?
Yeah, this is just on the schools, which promotes a 15-point grading scale, passed its first reading in the House on Monday and has been referred to the committee Education K-12. The proposed bill would mean higher grades for lower scores by changing the grading scale as follows. A is now 100 to 85%. B is 84 to 70%. C is 69 to 55%. D is 54 to 40%. And press F for anything below 40. holy fuck. I mean, everybody's going to be on the same scale, right? But like, we all know why this is happening.
Yeah, we definitely do. And, you know, people will be pointing out, like I did, that this is just the grading scale, you know, that's going to be applied to the school districts themselves. But this is just step one to get the new sort of convention in place. 85. Dude, when I was in school, anything below 65 was failing. And yes, you had to have a 93 or better for an A.
Yeah, same deal, man. I mean, that's, yeah, like if you weren't in the mid to high 90s, if you weren't pushing for 100 on test scores, like what the fuck were you doing? But yeah, no, now it's, and some of this has to do with teachers not allowed to give Fs for if there's something on the paper, like that's a new thing. Like you're not, if you can only give an F if you get no homework assignment or a blank piece of paper. But if there's like somebody scribbled, like you can't give an F because at least they tried something.
Don't get me started on how much fucking homework is waited for these days. That's the other scam here.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah,
you can't just like be smart.
No. No, it's dude, it's a shit show. So, yeah. And of course, you know, people have known sort of about the immigrant college graduates for a while being well below U.S. graduates. And then U.S. graduates, where are they? Like, as you pointed out, it's like, how great are they these days? Like, how do U.S. graduates of the current year compared to U.S. graduates of 1995 and 1985? I suspect it is a precipitous decline.
Yeah, just I mean, thinking about things in like the mid 90s versus now, which were, you know, not great, obviously, all of the rot, everything that we're talking about here, you know, was well underway at that time. But still, it's an extremely rustling juxtaposition.
It is. Yeah. So also speaking of legal immigration, according to The Hill, U.S. has denied tens of thousands of visas in 2018 due to the travel ban, if only it had been done right the first time. According to Reuters, the department refused 37,000 visa applications because of the travel ban, which mostly affected people from Iran, Libya, Somalia, Syria, and Yemen. This is up from less than 1,000 visa applications that were denied in 2017. So very significant increase. The ban faced numerous legal challenges and didn't take fully effect that year. So I wonder how many, they don't mention how many were denied in 2016. I suspect that it was probably a negative number, given all the people who probably just came in here and overstayed anyway. So, that the ban is working out pretty well. If only it were increased in scope.
Yeah, nice to see some positive effects from it now that it's been in effect for a while. And, you know, all the legal challenges have been sorted out and has had an opportunity to stabilize. 37,000 now, up from 1,000, percentage wise, obviously that's a huge increase. We're only talking about 37,000 fewer of these people, but you know, you gotta take any at this point.
Oh no, it's a little bit higher than that. So there are actually 15,384 immigrant visas, and then another 21,645 non-immigrant visas that were also refused as part of the ban. So it's a little bit higher. But yeah, I mean, what they don't say in the article is, which should be readily available to go look up, would be the total number of applicants and what percentages were banned. I would love to see that number in the 90s. 93% is an A, right, Howersham? So
yeah. Striving for an A plus here. I think that was like 97 and above.
Yes. A plus rating, 97 and above. Yeah. So one last thing here, maybe two last things. So we have this Lindsey Graham article in the New York Times. You read part of it, didn't get to read the rest. Then I think you went back and read it at my behest because I read the whole thing. And at first I read it and I was like, oh, ho hum, this is going to be just another sort of introspective on Lindsey Graham. But it's actually, there's some pretty gold quotes in here. Pretty interesting insights on Lindsey Graham.
Yeah, definitely. Especially the stuff about his relationship with McCain and how that suffered as a result of the tactic that he was employing, RE the president suffered. And I guess there was a little bickering that occurred before the greatest American ever passed away.
Yeah, it's so funny how it's described too as a political marriage. Lindsey's words, not anybody else's. So yeah, so the way to understand this article, the takeaway from this, the TLDR for those of you out in Rio Rhinelander, is that Lindsey Graham is a Jewish trick. And he's been a Jewish trick for a while, and it works out well that Lindsey Graham is a Jewish trick because he gets to be in power. I think in the article somewhere he says if you're not running for re-election, then you're in the wrong business. So that's, you know, Lindsey Graham is always running for re-election. He's always, as he puts it, trying to remain relevant, and to remain relevant means that he is going to seek self-preservation. But this benefits not just himself. This benefits other people. So the reason why he's doing what he's doing is that because the silent generation is dying, boomers are not far behind them. There is not much of a market for ma respectable conservatism. It's really losing its luster. There's not this whole "this is not who we are" stuff is sort of only being applied in like racial terms now. It isn't really being applied in like principled constitutional republics, except when you're talking about the emergency declaration. Then it's a constitutional issue, but almost you never hear much about this. And so there's very little market.
No, they're trying to use it in increasingly sparingly, I think, aware that the effect is diminishing rapidly.
Yeah. Well, and then it's also like, well, what are we? And of course, it's never defined. This goes way back to earlier FTNs when we would talk about this. It's never defined because the conservatives are only defending their positions of 10 years ago. And that's just never is defined. Like, this is not who we are. Well, who are we? Are we the way George Washington defined the country? Because he was basically a white nationalist. So is that who we are? Cause that's who I'd like us to be. But no, you're saying this is not who we are based on some amorphous sort of definition. And so there is no market. There's no marketplace for that many Mitt Romneys and Jeff Flakes. Like we've said, there's no cuck insurgency. They try, but the cuck insurgency is sort of this proto Lindsey Graham, where they sort of remain relevant in order to fight another battle. Flakes and Romneys die on their sword. Mitt Romney is going to have to adjust his strategy pretty soon. Jeff Flake and some of these others were unwilling and they went down swinging. They're out of power. Who cares about Jeff Flake now? Nobody. Nobody gives a fuck about Jeff Flake. Nobody.
Yeah. And as the article points out, with him being up for re-election in 2020, in the seat that Strom Thurmond once held, this was never really going to work out any other way than him doing what he's doing. I mean, he needed to do this for the sake of his own election, you know, in a couple of years. But just, yeah, him recognizing like, I'm not really of value to the people that I'm on Capitol Hill to be of value for if I'm doing that bit. I don't, you know.
Yeah, he's got to strike this balance of, you know, people that elected Strom Thurmond to this seat, which Lindsey took over in 2002. Those people have pretty high expectations. They don't want a Mitt Romney. They don't want a Jeff Flake. And so Graham has to, as he puts it, put on the showcase year. This is a showcase year. This is what him and McCain define this as. This is a showcase year for Lindsey Graham.
Oh, yeah. The quote that phrase is from in the article. Graham reminded me that when McCain was facing re-election in 2010, he turned himself into, quote unquote, the most conservative member of the U.S. Senate. That was the race in which McCain claimed that he never embraced the Maverick label. And people were asking what happened to John McCain. Graham chuckled at the memory. Yeah, I mean, and he had to. People were still very pissed at him for his extremely poor showing in the 2008 election.
Oh yeah,
basically that he fucking threw it or just didn't have the skills to pay the bills and take Obama to task on the burgeoning anti-whiteness that you were seeing even then.
Yeah, because this is when the GOP took back the Senate, I think fully in 2014. I mean, people were like, why didn't McCain run this type of race in 2008? If he had done that, he would have won. But of course, it's obvious what he was doing. That article goes on to say, in acknowledging this, Graham was speaking to me as a fellow creature of Washington. Speaking to me is the interviewer of the story. Fully versed.
The person saying that just as a reporter, like this is not a politician.
Yeah, a fellow creature of Washington, indeed. Fully versed in the election year showcasing he is now engaged in. One of the people who are so smart that he derided the day before. If you don't want to get reelected, you're in the wrong business, says Lindsey Graham. And that's true. This is election year showcasing, just like when Lindsey Graham proposed birthright citizenship legislation the last time he was up for reelection, 6 years ago. That's when that happened. That's when people are like, oh, what happened to Lindsey? Yeah, that's when he had to stroke the bona fides. And the people in South Carolina have to get a little bit smarter about this. Because and Lindsey Graham himself is not very smart about it, because if you go back to the 2016 race, who remember, it struck many people who knew Lindsey Graham as knew him previously when he was running against Trump, who as a presidential candidate in 2015 decided to yell out Lindsey Graham's phone number at a campaign event after Lindsey Graham called Trump a jackass. I mean, Lindsey Graham was in it for himself in 2016 until he wasn't. And then he had to go cross back over and be a friend of Donald Trump. And so that's the whole game here.
Yeah, I'm just reading about the dynamic of his relationship with John McCain that the article sort of delves into regarding the political marriage. Graham has always gravitated toward larger than life figures. He worshipped his father and followed him everywhere. Graham's parents died. Oh, this is what you were talking about yesterday.
Yeah.
Graham's parents died when he was in his early 20s, and he never married or had children of his own, which has forced him throughout his career to deflect the inevitable insinuations that arise about a 63-year-old bachelor in the U.S. Senate. Graham says he has dated numerous women over the years, but he usually lands on some variation of the married to my job explanation for his lack of a partner. In the same way that he described the regulars of Sanitary Cafe as members of his extended family growing up. Yeah. That's not the quote that I thought it was.
Well, no, it is. That is the important part, because his parents owned a bar, and his dad was never really around much, and that he was sort of this entertainer for the bar, and the members of the bar were like his surrogate brood into adulthood. And so the point of all this is that, like, father figure was largely absent, died in his early 20s. Graham was basically like this, you know, this mascot of the bar. Who knows what really happened there? We don't really know. I'm not insinuating anything happened there. But the bottom line is that he has always had this affinity, this attraction, this need for an older man in his life. And that older man has been John McCain. The story goes on to say nearly every Graham story of the last two decades involves John McCain. When you enter the waiting area at NBC's Meet the Press, there is a framed photo of McCain and Graham sitting together on the set, like a portrait of the extended family of the Washington Green Room. They were inseparable, Susan Collins, the Republican senator from Maine, told me. John's death really left a hole in his heart. It seemed like Lindsey had lost a father, or something like that. Graham, who served in the United States Air Force and South Carolina Air National Guard, likens McCain less to a father figure than to an older brother or perhaps a commanding officer. What I miss was the collaboration in the bedroom. No, what I miss is the collaboration, Graham said. It was a political marriage. I asked Graham if his collaboration with Trump, such as it was in any way akin to a political marriage. Oh, gosh, no, said Lindsey. I personally like him. We play golf. He's very nice to me.
Yeah, I'm sure that's the way that the president would like the extent of their relationship to remain.
Yes. And apparently, because McCain was still alive during one of several of Lindsey Graham's many transitions throughout his life. You know, he voted for Evan McMullen in the 2016 race. Everybody remembers. But after Trump became president, Graham decided that forging a relationship with him served his conjoined interests. Yeah, conjoined interests. Let's talk about all the other interests that are involved of staying relevant in Washington and getting reelected in South Carolina. Which is important, because Graham running for re-election in South Carolina, like we pointed out in 2020, there's no way that he could be anti-Trump. So he does say, Graham told me that McCain understood his willingness to make peace with Trump. Of course, McCain had to be relevant through the extent of Graham's ingratiation. Bothered McCain quite a bit, especially Graham's over the top praise for Trump's golfing abilities. So I'm sure Graham was regaling a dying McCain with how great Trump is at golf. And McCain was probably like, ah, okay, Lindsey, enough. Okay.
It's like, yeah, you told me three times now it was a good shot. I get the picture.
Yeah. Yeah. So the article sort of goes on to say, it starts to talk a bit about how Lindsey has ingratiated himself with Trump and, you know, the price for relevance, it goes on to say, for Graham has been a willingness to defend the president on television and speak out on issues that he know might be of minor consequence in the scheme of things, but clearly animate Trump. And then you get right down to the juice. When I asked Graham whether he ever worried about being seen as a toady to Trump, his voice assumed a slightly clipped edge. No, here's what I worry about. That we're going to get it wrong in Syria and Afghanistan. I worry about the policy stuff, and I have influence, more influence than I've ever had with the president. Graham credits his relationship with Trump with the president slowing down his decision to withdraw from Syria. Mm. He noted that Trump asked him, this is fucking hilarious. He noted that Trump asked him about whether the United States should use force in Venezuela. Graham said that he preached caution, which is a shock, actually, and that Trump became exasperated or pretended to be. He said to me, "You want to invade everywhere except where I want to invade," Graham said, laughing.
It's like, oh, no, we're not our own hemisphere. Don't worry about that.
Yeah, it's like, yeah. And it's sort of illuminating that at least there's an admission there, whether that's a joke or whether it's serious, is that Trump does genuinely want out of the Middle East, but he doesn't see his ideology, his sort of stance on that as universal, because it's like Lindsey is trying to say, don't get involved in Venezuela, and Trump wants to. It's like, Trump, come on, like, just stay at, like, America first. Remember that this is, you're supposed to be your mantra.
Yeah, I mean, he probably somewhere in his mind, by his calculation, it would be his sort of like resurrection of the Monroe Doctrine or whatever. Meanwhile, Lindsey Graham's just like, you give Shlomo whatever the fuck he wants.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and this has resulted in, you know, the number there being some number greater than zero of troops still in Afghanistan and Syria, and that whole thing is being slowed down because Lindsey's in his ear. And Lindsey goes on to say that he has achieved this access to Trump's inner orbit. He says, Graham says he's achieved graduating levels of relevance with Trump. I went from, okay, he's president, to how can I get in his orbit, to another favorite Graham word, which is orbit. How can I have a say in what's going on today, tomorrow, and next week? I asked Graham if he considered himself part of the wider Trump orbit or the more select one. And he said, well, I'm getting into the smaller orbit now. And I asked him who else was in that precinct of the Trump solar system. He mentioned, of course, well, Melania is sort of to be expected, Ivanka, Jared. And then he's got a few old friends that still have a say-so, New York types, but the circle is small. Who knows? I'm not even I couldn't even begin to guess who the New York types are, but probably just people that Trump has stayed in touch with for a long time. I mean, up until recently, Roger Stone was a really good friend of Trump's, but there's probably some others as well. I'm sure there are people who could venture some guesses. I have some ideas in mind, but.
Yeah, it's like, what was that? Like from Ted Cruz back in the campaign, like we know what these people are saying when they say New York types.
Yeah, well, I would think that Lindsey Graham is philo-Semitic enough not to mean that, but he very well could. I don't think he's trying to be pointing anything out. But to him, it's just city slickers, you know, people from Trump's business world that Graham really isn't a part of, doesn't understand, and doesn't belong in.
Speaking of those two Zio shills on Meet the Press, I just sort of wonder how long John McCain is going to hold the record for appearances as a fucking dead guy, because it's going to take a while before the next person catches up. Hell, it probably is Lindsey Graham.
Yeah. Yeah, it's probably Lindsey Graham. I mean, that's what he's going for.
Patrick Leahy.
Yeah, and you got to look at Lindsey Graham as you know, somebody who's only, what, 50? He was born in 1955, so he's not that
63,
old.
64.
Yeah, 64 years old. He's got a lot of time left, and Thurmond was, fuck, I mean, that guy was 100 years old while still in office. So, yeah, I mean, Graham is not going anywhere unless the AIDS gets him first. It's just to sort of close this out. At the end of our second interview in mid-February, I asked Graham if he trusted Trump. Graham's eyes seemed to bulge for a split second. You mean more than they are usually bulging? He sat back in his chair and paused. "That's a good question," he told me. He paused some more. "Do I trust him?" He said at last, I trust the president to be successful. The president's mercurialness, he acknowledged, could be a problem. He will change his mind in a New York minute, Graham said. You never know where he'll be. I mean, I woke up one day and we're pulling out of Syria. So,
yeah, yeah. You mean the red Shlomo phone was ringing off the hook?
Pretty much. Yeah, I'm sure that's what it was. And then good for Lindsey, good for Shlomo. At the intersection of all this theater is that he wants to be a successful president, Graham said of Trump. And I want him to be successful under the terms that I think are good for the country. Understood but unspoken was that these terms were also good for Lindsey Graham. So,
of course,
it is nice to see, though, that despite the influence of Jared, the undue influence of Jared, Ivanka in Syria, that Lindsey Graham is still could wake up at any moment and find out that Trump has decided to make very evasive moves such as pulling out of Syria, which has ended up being an 80% reduction. It's not 100%. But it shows that, yes, he's getting bad ideas, but Trump can decide at any moment what the hell he's going to do. And I, you know, I got to give the guy a little bit of credit. I like him being erratic in the erraticism of Donald Trump can be just as good as it can be bad, as we've seen sort of play out. But yes, Lindsey Graham is a Jewish trick. That's all he is. He's seeking re-election. And whenever Trump goes away, whether that's 2020 or 2024, you can bet a large sum of money that Lindsey Graham is going to go back to. He's going to retcon his support of Trump. He's going to want to point to these. I was still a neocon sort of decisions. I didn't, you know, support the president on this. I didn't do that. He's going to be able to walk through this and, you know, still gain all the upcomings that a lot of the MAGApedes sort of assume is really loyal support of the president. But you can see in his hesitation of answering the "Do you trust Donald?" It's like, so.
Yeah, I mean, someone asks you that question about the president who is a member of your party, you don't fucking hesitate.
No.
You just say yes.
Unconditionally. He's the commander in chief, after all. Right, Lindsey? That's the correct answer.
Yeah. Lay a little bit of that on there.
Yeah. So I think it's time to head over to good old Albion Dispatches. We will be right back here on Fash the Nation midweek. Talk to you guys in a bit.
You're listening to the show that changed your weekend forever. Fash the Nation. Fash the Nation.
This is Atlas, and these are the Albion Dispatches, collected by Alfred the Average, documenting the oppression of native Britons by a hostile elite and its vibrant clients in the epicenter of Clown World. Delaying Brexit? What a preposterous idea. Who would do such a thing? Well, Theresa May would. During a statement in the House of Commons on Tuesday afternoon, Mrs. May said that she would make three commitments. Quote, "First, we will hold a second meaningful vote by Tuesday the 12th of March at the latest. Second, if the government has not won a meaningful vote by Tuesday the 12th of March, it will, in addition to its obligations, take a neutral, amendable motion under Section 13 of the EU Withdrawal Act by Wednesday the 13th of March at the latest, asking this House if it supports leaving the EU without a withdrawal agreement and without a framework for a future relationship on March the 29th. So the UK will only leave without a deal on the 29th of March if there is explicit consent in the House for that outcome. Third, if the House, having rejected leaving with the deal negotiated with the EU, then rejects leaving on the 29th of March without a withdrawal agreement and future framework, the government will, by the 14th of March, bring forth a motion on whether Parliament wants to seek a short, limited extension to Article 50. And if the House votes for an extension, seek to agree that extension approved by the House with the EU and bring forward the necessary legislation to change the exit date commensurate with that extension. Short, hey? We're looking down the slippery slope, folks. Time to place your bets. Unsurprisingly, Nigel is unhappy. Writing in The Telegraph, he said, quote, Theresa May's endless assertions that she will deliver the Brexit the people voted for is beginning to look as if it was a deceit from the start. The only way Brexit can now be delivered, and faith kept in our democratic system, is to leave on March 29th on WTO terms. Yeah, that isn't happening, Nige. In fact, the second referendum is looking more likely than a no-deal Brexit, from Sky News. A Commons amendment has been tabled by the Independent Group, made up of 8 former Labour MPs and 3 ex-Conservatives who left their respective parties last week. Many of them left because of Brexit. The amendment, which could be put to a vote on Wednesday, has the backing of MPs in the Scottish National Party, the Liberal Democrats and Plaid Cymru. This would set out the steps necessary for preparing for another public vote on whether to proceed with exiting the European Union on terms agreed by Parliament, or to stay a member of the European Union. Things are heating up as the deadline approaches. Another day, another victim of global homo diversity oppression, from the Mail Online, a student who claimed the NHS should not be free to immigrants and lamented about the Islamization of Britain has been kicked out of his university. Sebastian Walsh expressed his controversial opinions during class seminars and the University of Central Lancashire decided to suspend him after they received several complaints about his behaviour. Here's what he actually said, quote, It all started off in a lesson when we were allowed to go off for a break. I went over to another table to try and socialise because everyone was still pretty new. I was trying to make friends with some more people. We got onto the conversation of food and what takeaways we ate. Now I went over there not intending to cause a debate. I just mentioned that I would never touch Subway or KFC because they use halal meat in their products. I don't agree with barbaric slaughter on any sort of animals for a religion. They kill the animal while it's still conscious. How inhumane is that? You wouldn't accept it if a vet did that to your pet. We went on to start discussing the Islamization of our country, and I think halal meat is contributing to that. I also mentioned that we have 30 to 40 Sharia courts in this country, which openly discriminate against women. If in our country we believe in equal opportunities for men and women, why do we allow this? I just don't agree with those courts and how they treat women. Then, in another lesson, we were asked about our views on the privatisation of the NHS. I said it should be privatised to the point where if you're not a legal UK citizen, you should not be entitled to free healthcare. Everyone says it's free, but it's not, because you pay tax for it. I don't want my tax going on someone who doesn't have the right to be here, and I'm sure that a lot of people feel the same. And that's all I said. A week later, I got an email stating that the university had received a report from my tutors which said my conduct was unacceptable. The university said that he can return to his studies if he undergoes some diversity struggle session, but Sebastian, being the absolute hero, is refusing. This lad did nothing wrong, and we should all express our support. Oi mate, do you have a license for your white privilege? One fellow does. In a rare instance of good news, a white heterosexual male won an employment tribunal against Cheshire Police, from the Manchester Evening News. Matthew Furlong, 25, whose father is a serving detective inspector in the force, had hoped to follow in his footsteps when he applied to join the force in 2017. After making it through to the interview stage, he told the tribunal he was told it was refreshing to meet someone as well prepared and that he could not have done any more. But Mr. Furlong, who studied particle physics and cosmology, was told he had lost out to other candidates, prompting his father to lodge in a complaint. The police force have now been found guilty in a landmark discrimination ruling based on the grounds of sexual orientation, race, and sex. His lawyers say it is the first reported case of its kind in the UK. One hopes it will also be the last, but this probably means the powers that be will only be forced to be a little more sneaky when applying affirmative action. Or to hell with it, just scrap the last paper-thin facade of equal opportunity. It's what the head of Britain's National Police Chiefs Council wants to do. Trust a woman to be respectful of diversity, from Breitbart London. Ms. Thornton, Chief Constable of Thames Valley Police, complained that favouring ethnic minority recruits was unlawful at the moment, and if you want to do something to give a shock to the system and say we can't wait till 2052 to bring the population of ethnic minority police up to their share of the general population, I think we need to do something different. Ethnic minorities officially amount to 14% of Britain's population. These are rookie numbers. True equality and diversity will only be attained once they number 100%. Let's end on some mentally ill clown news from Breitbart London. A governor of the NHS Trust in charge of England's flagship child sex change clinic has resigned in protest amidst allegations it it was fast-tracking young people into gender reassignment as a result of pressure from highly politicized LGBT campaigners. Breaking off a 35-year-long association with the Tavistock and Portman NHS Foundation Trust, Marcus Evans quit after it dismissed an internal report branding its gender identity development service, GIDS, not fit for purpose. Adolescence and childhood is a time when people are developing socially and biologically, a time when young people are identifying with different groups and with male and female aspects of themselves. Mr. Evans told the BBC's Today programme Monday, "There is pressure from the child who is in a distressed state. There is pressure from the family and the peer group and from the pro-trans lobbies. And all of this puts pressure on the clinician who may want to help the individual to resolve their distressed state by going along with a quick solution." Dr. David Bell, who drew up the report, warned children were at risk of a long-term damage as a result of the NHS clinic's inability to stand up to pressure from transgender activist groups such as Mermaids UK. Staff governor at the time of compiling the report, Dr. Bell, said clinicians felt children were being put into life-changing drugs without sufficient assessment of the role played by their personal histories and by wider psychosocial issues in patients' gender dysphoria. State enforced sex reassignment for all white males in 10 years. Place your wages now. News for this edition of Albion Dispatches was sourced from Breitbart London and mainstream UK media sources.
And now, back to Fash the Nation, heard only on the TRS Radio Network.
And we are back, thanks to Atlas and Alfred the Average for this week's installment of Albion Dispatches. Before we get to the crowd pleaser, reparations, we have some quick anecdotes about the breakneck pace of the changes taking place in the Democratic Party, starting with one of AOC's advisors commenting on the Sunrise confrontation between environmental activists and Dianne Feinstein, referred to the aging Jewish senator as an old timer and many other pejorative references to her age, talking to TheHill.tv's Crystal Ball and Buck Sexton.
Mm.
When we're younger, we tend to have much bigger ideas as to what's possible. We're more energetic, we're less tired when we're younger, and that means we tend to view many more things as feasible than elderly folks do, said this guy's, what's his first name? Anyway, Mr. Hockett, we shall call him. When an old timer in the Congress sort of poo-poos them or dismisses them and even is so cynical as to say, well, you can't vote for me anyway, so I don't care. It's in a certain sense unsurprising and yet in another sense very, very sad, he said. Mr. Hockett went on to say, I think for that very reason, they have a much greater sense of urgency. On the one hand, because they're going to have to live with the most profound effects of climate change in a way that old timers in the Congress are not going to have to. So, oosh. Pretty rough stuff there.
Yeah, Feinstein mounted a pretty significant defense of her seat this time. Really didn't, with the party, didn't deserve a second term. She... Kevin DeLeon should have beat her, but she managed to pull it together. There's still enough power there for her to do that. And of course, she's going to pay the price. She thinks that she's getting a comfortable six more years. She doesn't not only understand the trajectory of the party, but she also doesn't understand that this is a shit test that she just really fucked up on, because she refused the shit test, but in their world it doesn't really work like that, so it's not even actually technically really a shit test, because the proper way of managing this, if she wanted to stay as relevant as Lindsey Graham, was to listen, because I don't think we had the audio when we were talking about it over the weekend. But I have now since seen the audio of this and the video, actually. And the proper play for Feinstein was to listen to them and tell them how right they are and say that she supports the ideas in the legislation, like a lot of the other establishment Dems have done to remain relevant. The ones who rebuke it end up getting themselves into a lot of trouble. And Feinstein shouldn't have cucked, but she cucked.
And she basically said that this isn't going to be possible. And she, I mean, she's right. $93 trillion for this Green New Deal, according to a study that was done. $93 trillion. And so rather than laugh at it and say how stupid it is, the proper play from most Democrats, establishment Dems who are trying to remain relevant, is they support the ideas in the deal. But, you know, even Terry McAuliffe came out and said that the Green New Deal is totally unrealistic. And, you know, these are some, you know, these are the old white people in the Democratic Party that are really living on borrowed time. I mean, I don't really see how they need to meet these shit tests, especially in the early stages of the 2020 primary. And they're not doing it right.
$93 trillion, huh? It's like that. It's like that line from the first Austin Powers. Why don't you just say a bazillion dollars?
Yeah, might as well. I mean, you know, when you slap together actual payment reparations and the Green New Deal, I mean, you're just talking about some obscene amount. But before we get to reparations, of course, I'm glad that Terry McAuliffe and Dianne Feinstein. Now, Dianne Feinstein is not white, obviously, but McAuliffe is ostensibly. I want these people to do what they're doing. I'm just offering advice on if I were in the position of Lindsey Graham or Terry McAuliffe, the way that they would live to fight another day. McAuliffe is doing it wrong, and so is Feinstein. They're sort of taken aback by the accelerationism within their own party, and they're sort of not doing it right. But they think that they're going to put this thing, as you pointed out on the phone this weekend, they're not going to put the toothpaste back in the tube on this stuff. It's the coalition of the ascendant. That bell has been rung. It is not being unrung. And there's no resistance to it. And so these older white, sometimes white presenting aspects of the Democratic Party are struggling with how to handle this. And it's not going well.
No, it is not. Keeping up with our narrative of breakneck pace change in the Democratic Party, we were talking about Mark Kelly throwing his hat into the ring to run against Martha McSally for that Senate seat. And we mentioned how that was seen as a win for Democrats, you know, trying to recruit good people to run for office. It's someone they had been after for some time. But, you know, a week or two goes by and apparently the activist class is struggling to try and find a more justice Democrats, someone of that type of bent to run for that seat also. Left-wing groups.
Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
No. If you, we're just going to sort of give the lowdown, but.
I was going to give the lowdown because I was just sort of going to say, I mean, last week when we were talking about this and you had the story in the prep, I was like, OK, well, Mark Kelly's like a white dude. And, you know, for those of you out in Rio Rhinelander, this is the astronaut husband of the congresswoman. Kelly Gabrielle Giffords is the wife. She was the one who got shot in the head and is basically a potato now. And her husband is trying to take a stand. You know, he's very anti-gun, but white. He's a white guy trying to run for Congress. And, you know, when you first rolled this story out, I was like, huh, so what's you know, because this guy's not going to accelerate much except on guns. But like even the husband of a congresswoman who was shot in the head and became this avatar for gun control that failed, not even you guy are safe from this, you know, this burgeoning brown wave that is coming forward. And so I think, yeah,
you got to do better than that. You got to have, it needs to be a direct appeal to take Whitey's guns.
Yes.
Which is what so much of this really amounts to at the end of the day and has for a long time. But you got to give the people what they want. Mark.
Yeah, well, I think you were about to say the left wing groups, they have been pushing for this guy named Ruben Gallego, a vocal member of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, to join the race and give liberals a more palatable option as they prepare for 2020. So what's not palatable about Mark Kelly? What is it? Gotta be skin color.
Know. The sort of old powers that be in the Democratic Party have thought this guy was a dream candidate. Like I said, they've been targeting him for some time, and that plan is already out the window. Sort of like a white woman winning the presidency running on the Democratic ticket, just like that's out the window too.
Yeah, I mean, this is a guy like this is a U.S. senator from Arizona. They would love to have a guy like Mark Kelly in there doing the anti-gun bit in the United States Senate. But instead, they are going to try to get Ruben Gallego to do the Durka Durka bit. Now, this is, of course, accelerationism that we want. I mean, obviously, like Mark Kelly, I want him to wake up and realize that nothing is going to save you. You're not going to win this, and your own party is going to throw you out, and it's because of your skin color. There's nothing that you can say or do to stop them, Mark. Nothing. They're coming for you, and it does not matter. It does not matter that your wife got shot. It doesn't fucking matter. It's all coming for you, and there's nothing you can do. You can't cuck hard enough to get universal party support to be a Democratic senator from Arizona. You cannot do it. And that's the reality. And these people are just in total denial. Now, he could try doing the anti-white bit. He could try doing sort of this grand pivot that Bernie Sanders is doing right now. But nothing's going to save you, Mark. Nothing.
Now, as we move on to the next topic, which is what everyone wants to hear about. I mean, it's so thoroughly illustrates like these people have lost control of their golem. You know, we've been saying that for a while, but it's definitely true.
It's definitely true. And there is a narrative, there are some narratives to say like this is all part of the plan. But look, this
is a bad obvious plan.
It's a very bad plan. Like the obvious state of sort of insurrection within the Democratic, but this is not part of the plan. They need, if you're smart about politics, they want a unified, cohesive Democratic Party where the base, this amalgamation of all these disparate interests is just unified behind anti-whiteness, that there's no question about who the front runners are, that there are only a handful of candidates running for president. And right now you're talking about 35 people, and the questions that are being asked, like this $93 trillion Green New Deal, and the reparations are something that they have tried to put to bed. I mean, Barack Obama came out and put forward a very spirited defense of not doing reparations at all. His pivot during the debates was something along the lines of, well, we need reparations in the form of education in South Carolina right here. And that was basically a Barack Obama's non. And he's sort of gone into depth. I think in his post presidency, he did an interview with I want to say it was Ta-Nehisi Coates himself, where Obama basically said, I as president only look at the things that are possible. And what was possible for me was to advocate for things that would help all people in poverty. And that was next to impossible. But, let alone, arguing for things specifically for African Americans. And Coates was probably just sitting there like, what a fucking cuck. This guy ain't even black.
Yeah, well, I mean, when it, we were talking, there was an article recently that we were discussing that where, it referenced some quotes from one of his advisors that basically laid out the strategy when it was election time. They were not talking about race at all. Obama did it, the only way that really it could be done at the time. And I think probably also sort of the way that suited him the best. But, now his presidency has caused this budding white racial consciousness and has also resulted in the election of Donald Trump, and everything just sort of proceeds from that. Now we're into phase two of the plan, and the plan basically is out the window.
Yeah. And I mean, it a hot take on this is that if there was a way for us to support reparations for all non-whites, I mean, let's just say that that was within the political realm of the possible, you would be talking about tens of trillions of dollars, if not more. And it would, you know, it would probably bring the economy to its knees. And because I love this idea, it's never going to happen. And I mean, Shlomo doesn't want this to happen either, because as much as they would love to give money to the Schwarze, it's not in a way that is going to be damaging to the economy. And
investors are not going to like that.
No, investors aren't going to like it. Blacks themselves don't even like it. I saw Juan Williams, who's black, sort of black. He said that. And of course, this is the revolutionary mindset, and this is the correct take. Blacks should be opposed to reparations because it would then be touted as a one-time deal that would let whites off the hook for centuries of oppression. And Juan Williams actually doesn't think that reparations go far enough and that the Gibbs would then stop after that.
Yeah, he views it as sort of like ill-advisedly taking the lump sum. I mean, he's also concerned about, you know, no longer being able to employ this anti-white rhetoric all the time. But there's also just, you know, the pure material considerations.
Yeah, like it's like, OK, we paid you and you're still behaving like black people behave. It's like nothing changed. The reparations, you know, this whole note. So
yeah, then you could really be like, all right, we did the civil rights bit. We gave you reparations and nothing ever fucking changes.
Yeah, I mean, I sort of wonder, like, you know, when I saw Bernie on TV at the town hall and, you know, all these people giving these platitudes toward equality and we need to fight this deep in. Like, if you could have showed these videos to people back in the 1960s during the civil rights debate and be like, guys, you're still going to be talking about this 50 years from now, and the problems 50 years from now are going to be much worse than they are right now. And none of this is going to solve a fucking thing. And Strom Thurmond had good takes. Strom Thurmond never apologized for any of his previous positions. Of course, he died in 02 and long before anybody had a chance and there was any sort of mob scene to get him to recant much of that. But of course, they came out afterward and said that he had a non-white a bastard child, apparently.
Yeah, well, don't they say that about fucking everybody, though, who you know, is like sort of in that position. But
But anyway, who predicted this? Reparations are becoming nothing more than a meme. We said this last week. There's not going to be an actual payment scheme for African Americans. First of all, not that I don't think that the Kreitarchy would be capable of upholding such a law, but it's not realistic that they're going to come out with a law that says black people get a check for X. Like, they're just not. I mean, it's not going to work out that way. They did it for Jews. 2% of the population, two no's. They're not going to do it with blacks. And I mean, this is yet another thing. And of course, not a single one of these candidates is talking about actual payments to black people, which is what Ta-Nehisi Coates wrote in his magnum shittus on reparations. That's what they really want. And anything less than actual check to T black person each month is unacceptable. So yeah, it's all a meme. It's all various Dem programs, but not for blacks. Yeah, well, it's like programs for everybody.
Maybe they unconsciously understand like reparations is what they've been getting. And it's not, it's like, no, it's like, it's my money and I want it now.
Yeah, kind of like, where my check at? Give me that check. So Warren is Elizabeth Warren. We have to address Ma inequality platitudes. She has some sort of universal child care plan that people below a certain income level would get free child care until the child is eligible to go to school. And then that would end. And then her thing is like
to go to work. I don't get it.
Yeah. Well, that's the funny thing about Kamala's plan, too. It's like you only get the Gibbs if you're working. So Elizabeth Warren, she says Native Americans, too. So she really said this, that they deserve the reparations, too. And so that's the other aspect of this that we've talked about, is that they're not going to roll out the 23andMe to determine who is a descendant of a slave and who is not. So by definition, it's going to slowly creep into all non-whites, anybody who suffered under white supremacy.
Yeah. I mean, if Native Americans were fucking smarter, they could have used the land and the particular legal, you know, arrangement surrounding us and them to, you know, to much greater advantage. Like, they, you know, they just figured out in the last 15, 20 years to do the casino bit. But I'm sure that there's other things that they could have been doing.
Dude, can you imagine if white people were given like large tracts of land as reservations in the American Midwest?
Hands off regulatory approach.
Totally hands off. I mean, they would have there would be nation states within the United States that the U.S. government would have to contend with in probably less than a decade. Whereas Native Americans, it's just like, just make sure the alcohol shipments don't stop and we'll be all right. So and the free cigarette, like the tax free cigarettes and everything else that they sell on the res. So Booker, as you pointed out last week, he's proposed giving these nest eggs to American children called baby bonds and, you know, some sort of government dollar amount. I think it's like $500 or something gets appropriated to each baby at birth. And then I think at age 18, it's worth like, you know, not a terrible sum of money that is designed to be like ready made college money or RIMS money or who the fuck knows, whatever. Of course, it'll be gone faster than you can say who dat. And it's, you know,
I like Mike's plan. I think it was also the sort of goes back to the old Dave Chappelle reparations skit. But if it ever does happen, you want to quickly get into the business of selling like cheap baubles and shit.
Yeah, yeah. Online warehouse for Rolls Royce rims and all kinds of shit. So Bernie was at the CNN town hall, asked by a young black woman on Monday night for his position on reparations. Do you have this drop, by the way? Or do I just
the quotes? No, I don't. I wish I did.
It's OK.
What does it mean, though?
Yeah, well, yeah. What does it even mean, though? Senator Bernie Sanders did not say he did or did not support reparations, but rather argued that inequality must be addressed. See, hear more of the inequality platitudes. When pushed by Wolf Blitzer specifically on the idea of reparations, the Vermont Independent, who is running for the Democratic presidential nomination, responded by pointing out that the term reparations is used in all kinds of ways. Thanks for pointing that out, Bernie. What does that mean? Senator Sanders asked of the word. What do they mean? I'm not sure that anyone is very clear. What I've said is that I think we need to do everything we can to address the massive level of disparity that exists in the country. I can't even get into my Bernie impression, but like,
nah, I don't do a very good Bernie other than saying like his name. That's about as far as my good impression goes.
Bernie Sanders. Yeah.
Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, there you go. That one's pretty good. You're going to have to brush up on the Bernie. I'm pretty good with Graham. I can do a pretty good Rush Limbaugh. You got to get that Bernie up to snuff.
Yeah. Yeah, I'll work on it. It's painful. Slow going.
Yeah, it is. Well, so here's the gold, though. This is Kabbalah Heretz. Of course, she has really pissed a lot of people off with things that she is saying. And Kamala's plan is called the Lift Act, which would only benefit working families. If you're not a working family, you don't get shit. and essentially, it's a $500 a month tax credit for working families and single people. So no small amount. They're trying to do like reverse universal basic income, like through the tax system. So not a check that you get. It's essentially just a tax credit. So these people will get a large lump sum when they do their tax refunds, and then that will get spent in the month of April, and they'll be back to square one as predicted by May 1st, probably sooner, if it even lasts more than 2 weeks. So, yeah, I think you have some drops with Miss Kabbalah Heretz on her mealy mouth support for reparations.
Yeah. So here she is. This was an interview with The Root. I guess she did an interview with The Griot also. So she was sort of she was hitting all those type of sites. They're basically the same thing. A lot of the content of the interviews is very similar. But here we go.
Should black people get reparations?
I think there has to be some form of reparations, and we can discuss what that is. But look, we're looking at more than 200 years of slavery. We're looking at almost 100 years of Jim Crow. We're looking at legalized segregation and in fact, segregation on so many levels that exist today based on race. And there has not been any kind of intervention done, understanding the harm and the damage that occurred, to correct course. And so we are seeing the effects of all of those years play out still today.
As president, you would be willing to lead a conversation on what reparations for black people would look like.
Yeah, including things like what we should be doing to take very seriously undiagnosed and untreated trauma. Take that very seriously. And what kind of resources are we going to put in that? What kind of resources are we going to put in communities to help folks heal and be on an equal footing? You cannot tell me that everyone is equal in a society when everyone doesn't have an equal path to opportunity for success. And if we are pretending to be and say we are a society that values equality under law, look, right across the street is the United States Supreme Court. In that marble is inscribed, equal under law. Well, if everyone is equal, if that is a concept that we value, which we say we do, part of the foundational values and ideals of our country, equality, then we have to understand we're not all being born. And we're not all living on equal ground in terms of opportunity for success.
Yeah, blah, blah, blah.
Dude, is that like Dre 2001 playing in the background? Like, it's just like the soft music. She sounds like she's high. And it's like, who's interviewing her? Willie Brown or like these two? I mean, it's just like, this is the mood. This is like what people expect on The Griot, apparently.
Yeah, the thing is, like, that wasn't even really the best clip as far as I'm concerned. You know, here she is talking about how it's going to be all identity politics and just woke AF 24/7.
But on the issue of race in America, let's be very clear that we had years where people were talking about, are we a post-racial society, which I have rejected from the moment that discussion began. No, we are not. Race is still a big issue in America. I have talked about how, you know, this term identity politics, you probably heard it. People start talking about identity politics. It's like talking about the race card. Right? Which is when you start hitting on that topic, people throw out that label to shut you up or to marginalize the significance of what you're talking about. So the most recent era of that, right, of the race card, you don't hear people talking about that anymore. What they say is they talk about identity politics. In particular, when you're talking about race or you're talking about religion or you're talking about sexual orientation, oh, that's identity politics. I gave a speech a few months back and I said, look, I reject that label. Because it seems to me it is brought up whenever we are talking about civil rights issues. And it is with the intention to shut us up or to marginalize the importance of the conversation. Because check this out. Two things. One, where we as a country stand on these issues is about America's identity.
Check this out.
Right?
Yeah, and this is sort of branching off into like all this. This is all a filibuster for I don't support checks to black people, right? Like it's not even a filibuster. This is all just she doesn't want to answer the question. And ultimately, like, she doesn't really have a good answer for this.
None of them do. I mean, with her, the first thing you would ask is like, OK, how does this work exactly? Starting with, would someone of your heritage be eligible?
Yeah. And she basically says it's not by heritage. It's by people's income level and whether or not they're working. And it's like for a black person, it's like their eyes just glaze over with the like yellow jaundice.
It's like it's run of the mill socialism. Bernie offered him that and they said, go fuck yourself.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and of course, the backdrop of all this, of the, you know, this is the way to understand this. It's very simple. Kabbala Heretz, we call her that for a reason. She is, besides Beto O'Rourke, is the number one recipient of nose dollars. And she has gotten a lot of nose dollars. And so she is going to cuck on these issues because this is not what they want. This is not financially and they're not incentivized financially for this. So I think I have the exact clip where she answers the question on this. Let's do a little 1.5 theater.
Well, listen, again, we had over 200 years of slavery.
Not that
we had Jim Crow from
this part.
And we understand that that's part of why we're doing it. Listen, the reality also is this. Any policy that will benefit black people will benefit all society. Let's be clear about that. Let's really be clear about that. So I'm not going to sit here and say I'm going to do something that's only going to benefit black people. No, because whatever benefits that black family will benefit that community and society as a whole and the country. Right.
Right. And the black person who's doing the interview is just like, like, yeah, it's such a cuck. Like, dude, how big of a cuck is that? I'm not going to sit here and say I'm going to go do something that's only going to benefit black people. If it and then she goes on this whole thing about, well, if you give people in poverty a lift up, it benefits everybody. It benefits everybody in the community.
Oh, yeah. And that's what black people want to hear. A rising tide lift all boats.
Well, dude, the responses have been swift. On Twitter, it's more of the same old trickle down politics, man. She's getting accused. She's getting the Ronald Reagan treatment here.
The knives are out. Trickle down is a hardcore pejorative in these circles.
Oh, yeah. Reparations means to repair or correct the damage done to a specific group. We as ADOS, which is what is
American
this company?
Descendants of slaves.
Yes.
I believe.
Extremists, as they're called by the J left establishment. Kamala Harris just admitted she's not willing to repair the damage for us specifically. I don't want a lift. I want reparation, responded another Twitter user. We will not go through what we went through with Barack Obama, says attorney and writer Antonio Moore, who is a co-founder of ADOS. In a phone interview with The Griot, Moore and his ADOS co-founder, Yvette Carnell, a political writer and fellow Howard University alum, which is a historical Blick college in Washington, D.C., for those of you out in Rio Rhinelander, reacted negatively to Senator Harris's plan. We are very critical of Kamala Harris' position in regard to a black agenda. The LIFT Act does very little, if anything, to correct ADOS substantial positional problem in regard to wealth. We're talking about how we make up the wealth that was lost because the cost that we paid from coming from Chattel slaves and the good God, this is hard to fucking read. Like what the. So.
Yeah, you're going to get banned over chattel slavery.
Yeah. Chattel slaves, cattle. You know, I know it's Chattel slavery. And the cost of those Chattel slaves paid. They didn't get any payment for in building the richest. Dude, who writes this? They didn't get any payment for, comma, and building the richest country in the world and not getting anything from it, period. Kamala Harris is talking about income, but she's not even talking about income or race specific ways. There's a lot of sick missing from that. Some critics have called, here's the kicker, some critics have called ADOS divisive and dangerous for its exclusive focus on black American descendants of slaves. Others, such as a recent commentator on MSNBC, suggested that its members were Russian bots or trolls. Both Moore and Carnell adamantly deny that claim.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of a basic bitch talking point, but it's useful, which is why Anne points it out. It's like all of these carve outs were only for these people because of slavery.
Yes.
And now it applies to every fucking fob, you know, from God knows where who got here 10 seconds ago. Yeah, but this is it's just not going to be well received. Tyrone going to be like, shit, I'd have been better off with Rand Paul's autonomous economic zones.
Yeah, well, I mean, and that's the thing is like that is the kosher Democratic Party. People who look at Kamala and think she's a non-white who's going to accelerate this thing. No. Kamala Harris is the one. Kamala Harris. Sure, there will be some acceleration with sort of with her. But like, as you can see with her answer here, and you're going to see with her answers to many other subjects, she is going to triangulate toward the kosher sandwich. And this is just another example. She has come up with this retarded solution, which I actually, the Lyft Act, I think would benefit in terms of non-whites. It would benefit them, obviously, in greater proportions. But in terms of sheer numbers, a $500 monthly tax credit to working families would actually benefit poor whites significantly. And that's another reason why the blacks would not like this.
Yeah, and they would be more judicious with the money.
Right. Yes. So it'd help them even more because they're white. And that's, you know, blacks, obviously, they want some sort of corrective action for that. But there is no corrective action despite trillions of dollars spent since the Great Society. But you're right. You're exactly right. I mean, this is all these programs were designed. So it's basically like more affirmative action. Well, not even affirmative action. They're not even calling for like specific things that help minorities. They're basically just, yeah, we got to help people in poverty. And, you know, that's kind of what everybody here is saying. And they're not very happy about it, as we can see.
Because there's two boxes that these people want to see checked. It needs to be, you know, a direct benefit to them, and it needs to be punitive. And this is not doing either of those things.
No. And so that's, you know, they're going to have to come up with other ways. Anti-white rhetoric, some of the filibustering that Kamala did about this is not a post-racial society. All the just rhetoric is going to be the thing that sort of excites the base. But ultimately, like, they're not getting what they want, and they're not going to get what they want. But what is happening is that you're getting these shit tests about reparations. Nobody wants to be talking about reparations. Believe me, they don't want to be having to come up with these solutions. This is an uncomfortable conversation to be had because, according to polling data, according to a 2018 survey from left-leaning Data for Progress, 26% of Americans supported some kind of compensation or cash benefits for descendants of slaves. A 2016 Marist survey also found that 26% of Americans said that the U.S. should pay reparations as a way to make up for harm caused by slavery and other forms of racial discrimination. I'll let you take the next one.
Yeah, in terms of a direct payment, reparations could be a tough political sell. In a point-taken Marist poll conducted in 2016, 68% of Americans said the country should not pay cash reparations to African-American descendants of slaves. Oh, so they're even getting in on the ADOS hashtag here.
Yeah.
About 8 in 10 white Americans said they were opposed to reparations. Well, about 6 in 10 black Americans said they were in favor. I figured that would honestly be higher.
Yeah, I figured it would be higher, too. But maybe there are. Well, you got the talented 10th who's probably going to take the Juan Williams position. And then probably other people who are like, I ain't answering that poll. Shit, I ain't talking to you. Like, so I'm sure the number is probably higher. But I'm sure there are some extremely woke blacks who are like, nah, we don't want that because, you know, here's what's going to happen. And they're probably right. If there was ever a world in which reparations were going to be given out, and they're not. So who would benefit? You know, this is the thing that we were talking about. How do you test descendants of slaves, all blacks? You know, what about rich blacks? You know, what about non-whites? This gets very complicated very quickly. And so, you know, the racial division on this is another reason why this is not, you know, whites don't want to do this. And if people like Kamala and Bernie and others in the front runner slots are dependent upon winning back voters who voted for Obama, white voters who voted for Obama, who voted for Trump, they don't want to be talking about reparations. Especially when not a single one of them is going to run on a platform that involves delivering on reparations in a way that's meaningful to these blacks. So.
No, they don't want to be talking about it, but it's not stopping them because it kind of can't be helped because of what they have wrought. Yeah, this is far less consequential because this guy's campaign is fucking going nowhere. But here was Mr. Bean Man coming out in support of reparations on the tube with Steve Kornacki.
It was on this question of reparations payments to black Americans with a family legacy that can be traced back to slavery. You said the country would be better off if it found a way to do that. And that's one of those. It's not an issue that really has gotten a lot of sort of mainstream discussion. The most recent poll I could find on it, I think it was about two or three years old. It showed 2/3 of Americans opposed that idea. There, we put up on the screen, 68% were against reparations payments. I wonder if you could just talk a little bit more about what it is you would do as president when it came to that. And if you are worried that that sends a message to that 68% of Americans who say they're against it, that maybe you are out of the mainstream a little.
Well, you know, this is not something that I think of through a political lens. I have long believed that this country should resolve its original sin of slavery. And that one of the ways we should consider doing that is through reparations for people who are the descendants of slaves. It is interesting to me that under our Constitution and otherwise, that we compensate people if we take their property. Shouldn't we compensate people if they were property sanctioned by the state? So I believe that is a conversation that's worth having. And I see that as right and wrong. I don't see that as political or non-political. So if I'm president, what I said was that I would establish a task force to look at how that might be done. I know that there's a lot of disagreement, both about...
Yeah, blah, blah, blah. I need black people to vote for me if I want to have a snowball's chance in hell. You know, it's always going to be a panel, a study, a this or that.
Well, he's deeply unpopular with non-whites. I mean, Hispanics don't even like him very much.
He comes off as completely insincere. I didn't notice this before, but like he's got this like BB Netanyahu thing going on with the way he talks.
Little bit. Yeah. Where are the reparations for the total destruction of white Western civilization? When do we get those reparations? Because we've sort of put everything that we've built, including some of the most beautiful architecture in downtown areas such as Detroit and New York and in other places, like all of this stuff has just gone up. And so like, when do we get reparations for what we built? All this stuff that we handed off that we thought that would make the lives that some other people, not me, thought that would make the lives of these people better. And it's made everyone's lives collectively worse. These people were better off in the places that they came from. And like I said last week, no reparations without repatriation. You know, we want our reparations too.
Yeah. I mean, the it's all in the wash at this point. The proof is in the pudding, as they say. I mean, the results, I think on the Civil Rights Act and the decades that have followed, it's pretty clear. You know, that's one of my old favorites from stuff black people don't like is what is the true legacy of the Civil Rights Act? Plexiglass.
Yeah. There were some other good polling questions related to race. You don't get these very often. I saw this in 538 that was divided up neatly into things that are popular, things that are sort of mixed bag, and then things that are unpopular. So you can sort of divide that as black pills, gray pills, and white pills. Just to give some of the highlights of these is we have some of the unpopular or some of the popular things, which would be unpopular with us. 86% of Americans believe a significant part of being truly American is accepting people of diverse racial and religious backgrounds, according to a poll released this month by the Public Religion Research Institute and The Atlantic. Fucking Christ.
The fucking schools did that shit.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. This is all schools. This is all. Yeah, totally. 78%. Yeah. So this is with the backdrop. This is what 60 years of propaganda in the schools does. Acceptance of non-white people. 78% say that being of Western European heritage is not important to being American. So I would love to talk to those 22% who say that it is. We need to get those people agreed and amplified. This one. Ending mandatory minimum prison sentences. 75% of Americans back this idea, according to a PRRI survey.
Yeah, I mean, we were talking about how that was a push pull, and if you and I had done it, or, you know, like I said, these people are always pissing and moaning about Willie Horton because that shit works. You know, you take one of these people that fucking, you know, got out of prison early because of one of these bleeding heart programs and, you know, did a home invasion and all sorts of other heinous shit, and forget about that.
Yeah, well, in that, yeah, you have to take these polls with a grain of salt, like the reparations poll that shows people 80% opposed and things like that. I actually think those numbers are a lot higher because you have the reverse Bradley effect, you know, and depending on how they're answering those questions, you're going to have cucky whites who probably believe that their money shouldn't go to blacks. But they're going to say, oh, yeah, we got to do something for them. And so they answer yes. So I think those numbers are probably lower than they should be. And but some of these are all virtue signal poll. Like the U.S. is a nation of immigrants. 73% of Americans hold this view. Thanks, public education system. A January 2018 HuffPost YouGov poll. Yeah. And it just goes on and on down the line. Optimism about bridging racial divides, allowing undocumented immigrants to become citizens. 62% of Americans support a pathway to citizenship. The country has not done enough to give equal rights to blacks. 61% of Americans hold this view. Muslims have a disadvantage, according to a majority. White people do have an advantage, according to 60%. I mean, dude, it's just.
Yeah, I mean, the people, you know, who are saying that we have not done enough to engender equality with blacks or whatever. I mean, aside from reparations, which is now insanely being talked about, like, seriously, what the fuck else would you have us do?
Yeah, what haven't we done? What haven't we done?
There's nothing.
Nothing. Yeah, I mean, you know, with the Jesse Smollett thing, lynchings aren't even happening. The ones that are happening are fake. So it's, you know, this is just all total bullshit. So that's the black pill. Mixed opinions, the gray pill. Being Christian is not essential to being American. About 56% face of Americans say that being Christian is not an important part of truly being American, according to a February 2019 poll. 39% said being Christian is important. Trump has emboldened people who hold racist beliefs to express those beliefs publicly. 50% of Americans agreed with this notion. Quinnipiac, 2018.
Express your beliefs publicly. How? By wearing a MAGA hat?
Probably.
Yeah. Yeah. Don't think so.
Yeah. Just saying it's OK to be white. Yes, that's a racial macroaggression. Black and Latino Americans each have some disadvantage for getting ahead in the U.S. And this is just another question asked in a different way. 51% of Americans say that they have some disadvantage. The, you know, 49% say no. So that's sort of interesting when you lump blacks and Latinos in there. So that's probably some of the propaganda of like people who just want to do jobs that you don't want to do. Hardworking Mexican families and shit like that. It's like, oh, blacks and Latinos. Well, some of those people aren't disadvantaged. That's probably, you know, the typical boomer response to this shit. But.
Yeah, they're fucking disadvantaged. All right.
Yeah. So here's one that's frustrating. The U.S. should not define itself as a country of Western European descendants. In the PRRI survey, respondents were asked to put themselves on a scale where one end is the statement that they would prefer the U.S. to be a nation made up of people from all over the world. And the other end is the statement that they would prefer the U.S. to be a nation primarily made up of people of Western European heritage. 47% said they mostly agreed with the first statement. So frustrating that it's that high. But the white pill is that 53%
say that the United States should be a country primarily made up of Western European heritage. Those numbers would be sky high in our favor without the 1965 Immigration Act. But we see what that has wrought as well.
It's like, yeah, I want my country, and it uses the word nation here inappropriately. It's like if you're talking about a country populated by randos, it's not a nation. But it's like, yeah, I want my country be populated completely by randos who are extremely foreign and hostile and alien and who don't get along with each other. It's like, where does a fucking such a bizarre concept even come from?
I can't imagine. Where have they heard this? Television, radio, music, and school, essentially everywhere. And the only people pushing back on it are people like us, people like Tucka. And, you know, from time to time, Donald Trump, who used to do it a lot more than he does now, needs to get back on track in that regard. So being born in the U.S. is not important to being an American. 46% of people in the PRI. Looks like they've written this a couple different ways in the article.
I think it's, I want to say it's PRRI, but
it,
I don't know.
It is. Yeah, it is. They've flubbed this a couple times. 46% of people in the survey agreed with the idea that being in the U.S. is not important. A similar share said being born here is important. So there seems to be some overlap between people who think being born here is important and people who think the country should be made up of mostly Western Europeans is important. It is important. Those are great. This is who we are. The people that are in those categories, that's who we are. Those are our values, not what other these fucking faggots say. So let's go to the white pills. There aren't that many, or at least 538 decided not to publish the white pills as much. But here's some white pills. Confederate monuments in public spaces should be removed. Only 39% support this view, according to a 2017 Quinnipiac poll. Nation of immigrants should increase. The number of immigrants in America should increase. 28% of Americans hold this view, according to a 2018 Gallup poll. 39% want immigration levels to stay the same, and 29% want them to decrease. So that's not bad. So only 28% want more immigrants. It's funny. They like in a super majority, they buy into the nation that we are a nation of immigrants. But by all about one third, less than one third actually believe we should have more of.
Well, that's how a lot of this stuff goes. If you do any drilling down beyond like platitude level.
Yeah. Yeah. And if these poll questions are asked in the right way, you're going to get results that are a lot more favorable.
Who doesn't like platitudes?
Yeah. Everybody loves platitudes. We already did reparations. The last one is abolishing ICE. 25% of Americans said they supported the idea. 54% want the agency to remain, and 25% probably don't speak English. I don't know where the rest of that poll went, but that's where we are with the polling. So
yeah, and then it's like how many of these people are non-white immigrants, regardless of their legal status. It's like I don't care what these fucking people have to say about any of these matters.
Yeah, well, and that's also like who makes up the sample size in this poll? Are any of the people in this poll illegal? Were any of the people in this poll, like, let's ask white Americans what they think about these things, not this just melting pot of garbage and sewage from shithole countries. So.
All right. So speaking of espousing support for the president publicly and how that tends to go these days, a woman who initiated a confrontation with a man wearing a Make America Great Again hat inside a Falmouth Mexican restaurant was taken into custody by ICE. The department said that she was in the country illegally. And I read some of the early reports said something about her being an immigrant from Brazil. Of course, it said nothing of the immigration status. And then I saw this story started to percolate on some of the sort of fringier news sites in the ecosphere, but eventually it was rocketing around the internet all over the place. Deportation officers with ICE's fugitive operations team arrested Rosiane Santos, an unlawfully present citizen of Brazil, today near Falmouth, Massachusetts, said ICE spokesman John Mohan. It's just a hat at the end of the day. The gentleman who was wearing the hat told a reporter who was interviewing him, "I don't really understand why people can't just express themselves anymore. Everybody has to get mad. I don't ever want to." It's like, yeah,
the guy who has not yet started paying attention.
Yeah, is this white tequila? I hope so. If it's not, yeah, he got an education today.
Yeah.
I don't ever want to assume people are illegal because I don't think that's fair to a lot of good citizens, he said on Tuesday, but then added, "It's good that they got her."
Oh, the Saxon begins to hate, I guess. Yeah, so leave it to Rosiane Santos, hot-blooded Brazilian woman. You know, these women are always like snapping and flying off the handle. You know, she probably saw the hat and reacted, because, you know, anybody wearing a hat like that is a white supremacist. And dude was like literally eating. And this bitch grabbed his hat off his head. She's being deported now. Yeah. And
she should have had a bite to eat, too. I don't think she had anything aside from about four mojitos.
Yeah, Jesus. Yeah. So, of course, this was at a Mexican restaurant, Casa Vallarta. And, you know, of course, she's upset. It's her ethno state, right? It's her food. It's her menu. This is Molly Tibbetts' dad was probably there at the booth across the aisle. And, you know, this is a grand old time. And so this guy, yeah, you know, wearing this hat, yeah, right,
to pull a move like that. And then it's like, do I really buy that shit that he was trying to lay off on that reporter?
Nah, maybe. Like, if you, the fact that this was at a Mexican restaurant and this dude like rolled up in there with the MAGA hat on, like he knew what he was doing.
Also, like, this is in fucking New England, though. It's like, yeah, you can't.
Falmouth. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh, man. So, yeah. So she's now facing deportation. Let's see here. Let's see if there's more information here. Yes. Deportation officers with ICE's fugitive operations team arrested Rosiane Santos, an unlawfully present citizen of Brazil, said ICE spokesman John Mohan, a local CBS affiliate, reported. Santos is currently facing local charges for assault and other offenses. She is presently in ICE custody and has been entered into expedited removal proceedings before the federal immigration courts. Yes. Adios.
And that's just to show how stupid this chick is. The guy was like, that was another thing. I saw in interviews with this guy, he was like, "I wasn't going to press charges, but then she knocks the fucking hat off my head again while the cops are standing there, at which point they have no choice, at which point you're fucking deported." Like, she could have avoided all this even at that point.
Yeah.
Potentially.
And this is why, you know, whether it's about a MAGA hat or whether it's about like this woman not getting a promotion, or this woman getting cut in front of waiting in line for the bus, or whatever the indiscretion, the perceived indiscretion, this perceived assault on her. This is her reaction, is violence and going insane. And so this is not a thing that's limited to black people. I mean, look what she does in front of the cops. So, yeah, we don't want these people in our society. It's not just her. This is the behavior pattern.
Yeah, you're right about that being her ethno state or whatever. She apparently she was under the impression that like any Mexican restaurant is like the Brazilian consulate.
Yeah, this is like, I mean, why wouldn't she think that? I mean, yeah, why wouldn't she?
Well, you're bullshitting.
So, yeah, there you go. So then in other news, there is an Israeli spacecraft
the perhaps the starship Samson sending a backup of human culture to the moon. Lunar Library, 30 million pages of backup human culture aboard an Israeli spacecraft have been sent to the moon on a SpaceX Falcon 9 rocket, which took off last Thursday night, carried humanity's entire backup plan on it. It was headed to the moon. The world's ultimate cold storage unit, the Arch Mission Foundation, created the Lunar Library, a 30 million page long compendium of humanity's greatest cultural offerings, encoded it on a specially designed disk meant to last a billion years, and sent it to the moon to keep it safe. The disk is being carried to its final resting place on the moon's surface aboard Bereshit, the Israeli spacecraft and Google Lunar XPRIZE contender that was carried to space by the Falcon 9.
Please help us, based space aliens.
Yeah. So, yeah, this is the, I call it the USS Samson, because it's like, yeah, when these people, when shit goes off the rails, like they want a backup drive of how to like construct everything. I guess somebody's counting on having a functional spacecraft in order to retrieve this object.
Yeah, they'll fill in the details at later. Some point down the road.
Yeah, so the Lunar Library contains a vast archive of human history and civilization covering all subject cultures, nations, languages, genres, and time periods. Everything from the contents of Wikipedia to compilation of human languages, Rosetta Project. So it's all got all kinds of shit on there. So, yeah, pretty cool. Yeah, someday this will be all that remains of what whites did. Greatest achievements. We did all this stuff. Then we made a backup drive on it of it all. And then we had people who want to destroy everything put it onto the moon for safekeeping. Really great legacy that we have.
Yeah, it's people are going to look back at this as a very strange time.
Yeah. If they're able to discern anything from it at all. I don't know if this was covered elsewhere, but we can at least give a surface level reading of it. If people haven't read this article, it's pretty long. It's a very long article in The Verge, entitled The Secret Lives of Facebook Moderators in America. I think it's actually called The Trauma Floor, and the subtitle is The Secret Lives of Facebook Moderators in America.
Correct.
Yeah. So,
I mean, it goes on at length about these people just being fucking unstable degenerates and the work environment, that's created. And so on and so forth. And these are the people who are, controlling, they're effectively controlling your speech. But don't worry, Goy, it's a private organization. It's a private company.
Yeah, this is the TLDR on this. And it is a long article. If you don't want to read any of it, then just listen to this segment. If you want to read some of it, listen to this segment and then read up to the part where they start diving into the personal stories about various people. And that's not a long read. If you want to read the whole thing, make sure you have some time. But I mean, this is the highlights of this is that Facebook now employs, through independent contractors who are Pajit companies, Cognizant is one of them. Cognizant has a huge contract with Facebook for these people who review and moderate Facebook posts. And one of these is in Phoenix. Phoenix also, for those of you out in Rio Rhinelander, is a large call center hub in the United States. Lots of call centers are in Phoenix. And so Cognizant is essentially set up another call center, but the call center is responding to Facebook posts that have been reported. And there are 30,000 employees that are independent contractors who work for Facebook who do this job full time, and they make about $28,800 a year. Facebook prides itself on giving these people $4 more than the minimum wage. These people are maybe some of them are normal. Maybe some of them get jobs and they're not sure what they're getting into. I'm sure the job requisition that's put out there for this particular position is worded in such a way. I'm sure it's not Facebook moderator. I'm sure they call it something else. But yeah, the whole purpose of this is that these people, having been exposed to all this stuff on the internet and having to go through this rigorous training, sort of some of them end up going down the rabbit hole of some of these fringe narratives. Some of them turn to degeneracy and fucking in stairwells and break rooms and shit like that. So,
yeah, we've made mention of this dynamic before. Also, obviously, the TDS guys, because they have more experience with it. But just, you know, sort of journalists who are assigned to be like the alt-right beat reporter. some of them end up headed for deep water.
Well, yeah, and that's what's sort of happened here, is the ones who don't end up like this. It says employees have begun to embrace the fringe viewpoints of the videos and memes that they are supposed to moderate. The Phoenix site is now home to a flat earther and a Holocaust denier. A former employee also tells us he no longer believes 9/11 was a terrorist attack.
Whoosh.
Yeah, so it's a long article, but the big takeaway from it is that every meme you post, every sort of thing that gets you zucked, just rest assured that you have made someone's life either difficult or one step closer to our points of view. So fear not. Someone sitting on the other end of that terminal is either being having the propaganda and the conditioning broken, or they are going into the break room to smoke a bong and have sex with some of their employees to push the pain away.
Oh man. Yeah. It's if you just want something to lift your spirits, it's a good read. I'm going to do one more.
Yeah, we can do one more. The only other aspect of this is the level of mental health offer. Well, it's actually in the article they talk about how little mental health is offered, but they do have counselors on the premises to help people. There are moderators that sort of counselors that help these mods cope with traumatic images, and they go through this training where they're sort of forced to decide what to do in certain situations, and a lot of people don't even make it through that. But the overarching thing here is, like, if they quit, they don't get any more help, and people are developing PTSD like symptoms after they leave the company. And there's an air of this that's sort of laying it at the feet of Facebook. But Facebook doesn't want to pay. I mean, the average Facebook employee makes $240,000 a year. The average mod makes $28,800. And the whole purpose here, of course, is to outsource this to people that are going to be in a very high turnover industry. And it's kind of a shit show. I mean, they don't need to have this at all, but ADL and stuff, you know.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if I could do for a couple bucks an hour more than minimum wage, like read the comments on Raw Story all day. just don't know. The specs one.
Especially if you're being audited like these people are. So like every 100 moderated posts that you perform, 5 or 6 of them go to some sort of super moderator who gets paid $1 more an hour than you do.
Brahmin moderator.
Some Brahmin, yeah. Then they decide whether you did a good job or not. So, anyway.
Oh, yeah, this next one is will be quick and dirty. I just wanted to do this because I distinctly remember it being a Tyrone meme some time ago. From the Daily Beast, Doctors Without Borders Ebola clinic attacked in Congo. Was mistrust the motive? An Ebola clinic operated by Doctors Without Borders in a war-torn Democratic Republic of Congo came under violent, fiery attack over the weekend, possibly by locals who distrust workers battling the deadly virus, the group said Tuesday. Although the reasons behind the attack are unclear and such violence is unacceptable, what we know is that the actors of the Ebola response, MSF included, and organizations with Doctors Without Borders, have failed to gain the trust of a significant part of the population said someone whose name I can't pronounce, the general director. All those involved in the response must change their approach and truly engage with the grievances and fears of the communities.
Jesus.
So it's like, you know, you can accept our help or you can not participate. But if you fuck around, that guy with the M240 over there, he'll be your provider.
Jesus. Yeah, man, this is just, well, why are we extending the helping hand at all? Well, We know why. Yeah, I think we know why, but this is just, oh, man, just fuck it all. Like, let the whole thing burn. I mean, I don't even know what to say at this point, but yeah. That's about all we got this week for the Midweek FTN. Join us on Sunday for this upcoming weekend FTN. It's going to be jam-packed, got a lot of stuff on the wall, got a lot of stuff on whatever comes our way Thursday and Friday. Hopefully not much, because there's so much fucking news here, I don't know what to do with it all. So
only the next 2 days will tell.
Yep. All right. We'll catch you guys this weekend.